say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Okay, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm really jealous of the job tonight's guest has. I always thought I would be a member of Congress one day. Every time I've gone to Washington, I stand out in front of that Capitol, look up at it longingly, and think, man, there's still time coming. But it ain't going to happen. Susan Wild has that job, and she plans to keep it. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Alan. And I remember talking to you before I got into this race.
Yeah, Susan called me. She was kind enough to, you know, make one of those respect calls that said, you're thinking about running for Congress? So am I, and it doesn't matter what you do, I'm going to do it anyway.
It wasn't quite like that, but I do remember the
I'm going to kick your butt in the election.
Not true. Did not say that.
But Susan Wild is the congresswoman from the now 7th Congressional District in Pennsylvania. And I'm proud to have her here on a radio with all of the what I consider to be the smartest radio listeners in the Lehigh Valley. People listen to NPR and WDIY. So, you know, the least you could do, Susan, and I'd notice you don't have that pin on, but those cool lapel pins, you do have it?
I have it on a necklace, which is the way most of the women have started to wear it.
I didn't know you could do it that way.
It doesn't ruin your lapel the way the pins do.
Yeah, well, I was hoping you could let me wear it as a lapel pin, but if it's a necklace, I guess you can't do that.
I'll take it off and let you wear it for the duration of the show, Alan.
I appreciate that. That pin gets you in places that most people aren't allowed to go. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, that's a neat old building. And I think of like the National Treasure with Nicolas Cage. You know, you picture the Capitol as having all these like secret places and stuff like that. Have you found any secret places?
Well, there are a lot of secret places. You're right about that. I'm still at the stage where I sometimes get lost going back to my office after I've voted on the House floor.
It's not hard to do.
So when I find these secret little places, it's usually by accident. When I went to get my flu shot at the attending physician's office, it took a lot longer than I expected it to because I couldn't quite find my way. Wow. But I will say the pin is great. We call it the easy pass for the security line. We get to bypass security. It's the best thing about it.
They're such cool little pins, and I really am jealous. So how do you like your new job?
I love my new job. So I've been very blessed in my legal career to enjoy what I was doing before I came to Congress, but this is hands down the best job
I've ever
had. I was going
to say, you couldn't possibly like being a lawyer as much as being
not
a lawyer.
This is hands down the best job I've ever had.
Is there anything about it that is different than you expected?
It's actually very much as I expected. The one thing that I guess I'm a little surprised by is how little extra time you have. I sort of envisioned being able to read, you know, important things, bills and history and policy statements for hours on end, and that is not by any means what we do. It's a nonstop frenzy of activity.
Yeah. So I guess the question then would be, when was the last time you were able to put jeans and sneakers on?
The last time I was able to put jeans and sneakers on was a couple of weeks ago on a Saturday when I went out to join the strikers at Advanced Auto Parts in solidarity with them.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. That's very cool.
That's the last time.
But you were still working.
I was still working.
So the metaphor of jeans and sneakers doesn't work
exactly.
Entirely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. What constituencies are you finding are more powerful than you thought they could be?
Well, you know, It depends on how you treat your constituencies. To me, every single person who reaches out to me has a lot of power over me. In the sense that I'm a first term congressperson, and I'm very influenced by what people ask me to do, what people ask of me, and the problems that they share with me. So I don't know that I think there's one constituency that's more powerful than another. I will say it takes a while to get over negativity on social media and, you know, bloggers and that kind of thing, but I tend to try to turn a blind eye to that.
You campaigned on a platform that promised you'd stand up for good government. And I think at the time people were saying, if we don't want people on the committee who want to be on the committee. But you got on the committee, right?
Yes, the ethics committee.
Yeah.
Yes.
Charlie was on it.
Yes.
And, you know, he went after Maxine Waters, who I think is great because she's, you know, been tough on the banks. I haven't seen anything. Have you? You don't? Is anybody under?
So it's the activities of the Ethics Committee are confidential, so we don't talk about pending investigations. But I think it's a really important committee to be on. I'm very, very committed to clean government, and I'm glad that Charlie was also. We see a lot of complaints that have to do with usually it's a staff interaction, and I don't mean sexual harassment, but possibly using staff inappropriately, you know, your official staff for political purposes, which is a big no-no. We often try to work through those issues. And a lot of it is, and I was just recently a co-chair of the Outside Working Positions Task Force. It was just two of us, a Republican and me. And we were dealing with the thorny issue of what kinds of outside positions can members of Congress hold. We don't hold other jobs, paying jobs, but, you know, boards of directors and that kind of thing that could potentially be a source of conflict. And I think these are important issues. I honestly, the job is so full time. It's really a triple time job. I don't know why anybody wants any kind of outside activity, period.
Yeah. What aspects of the job are mundane? I mean, the kind of stuff that you wish you didn't have to do and you shouldn't have to do.
You know, there are only two things that I can think of that I would characterize as something I don't want to do. One is the commute from the Lehigh Valley, which I have yet to perfect. We go back and forth every single weekend, often on a Friday evening, which getting out of D.C. on a Friday evening is hell.
Dealing with Baltimore,
yeah,
Wilmington,
Baltimore,
Philadelphia.
Exactly. And unfortunately, as we all know here in the Lehigh Valley, we don't have train service to the Lehigh Valley. So even if I were to take the train, I still have to deal with
drive to Philly,
30th Street Station or Wilmington or whatever. So that's a major frustration. But, you know, then I compare it to people. I have a colleague who flies to San Francisco and then has to drive 3 hours home. Oh. So, you know, I really shouldn't complain about the commute time. At least I'm on the East Coast. And then, of course, you know, people don't talk about it enough, but the role that fundraising plays in these jobs is really wrong. And you asked about mundane. I don't know if I call it mundane as much as I call it frustrating.
Yeah. The last Democrat who represented us in Congress was Paul McHale. And Paul said that he would spend his morning doing his congressional morning and part of the afternoon doing his congressional business. Then he'd go out the back door of Cannon. Or it might have been Longworth, and into the Democratic National Committee's headquarters and spend hours on the phone having to raise money. And, you know, having a lot of money is a good way to scare away opponents. So is that the kind of thing you're still stuck doing?
Well, a lot of people are. I've taken a different approach to it. My staff knows I will not leave a committee hearing to go do call time, as it's referred to. A lot of us do call time at what we call the D trip, the DCCC.
Yeah.
But I also do it from home. I'll do it on a weekend sometimes, although people don't love getting weekend phone calls raising money. But mostly I do it in the evening at the end of the workday. And I'm not the only one. There are a number of my colleagues there making phone calls into the evening. So that when I say it's a triple time job, that's one piece of it.
I've had a lot of experiences in my life that I was in the middle of and thought, how did I get myself here? I mean, I met with Alan Greenspan in the governor's, you know, room at the Fed, for example. I was down in Washington at a conference, and the guy who runs the entity that does lobbying for community action agencies asked me if I had any interest in being a part of a meeting with Steny Hoyer. And so, Steny Hoyer, hell yeah. For those of you who don't know, Steny Hoyer is a longtime congressman from Maryland who is number two.
Yes, he's the majority leader.
Right. And so, man, if you're the slightest bit wonkish like I am, I jumped on that. So I get to the point of time, and the meeting is just me and this lobbyist and Representative Hoyer. It was in the building back behind you, and like the halls were unmarked, you know, the room was Spartan. It was not much bigger than a closet. And there I am talking to Steny Hoyer about fundraising for people running for Congress. And mm-hmm. It's just an amazing culture, an amazing place. And, you know,
it is. I just want to say another word on the fundraising. You know, Alan, that the first thing that we passed in Congress was H.R. 1. Of course, it's stuck on Mitch McConnell's desk along
as
with
is everything
about 300 other good yeah. bills. But the main thrust of H.R. 1, aside from reinforcing and expanding the Voting Rights Act, is to bring some sort of public financing to campaigns, because the way we're doing it is really just wrong. It's not the way any other civilized country does it, and it's a major problem.
Do you have opinions on how to do it differently? I do.
Yeah, I do. I think we need to follow a different model altogether. I think we need to shorten our campaign seasons. I think we, you know, Canada and other countries do not allow television advertising, which of course is a huge expense.
Yeah.
Probably 70% of what we raise is for television commercials. So, you know, there probably are a lot of consultants out there, my own included, who would not be happy to hear me say that. But I think that I think there are a lot of things that we need to do that would make this a saner process.
I think public financing of campaigns is appropriate. I think in exchange for that, you ought to have some certain restrictions, like agree to limit spending on
yes.
the race.
Yes.
And I think that I wouldn't abandon television advertising, but I would require that the ad only have the face of the candidate talking to directly to the voter and not make reference to the opponent. You mm-hmm. can only talk about your position on the issues. And I think television ought to give that for free, because they're using airwaves that are essentially the public space.
Those are all really good ideas, Alan.
And, you know, because, I mean, it's completely out of control, and it's disgusting.
And it's annoying. It's yeah. really annoying to people to get phone calls.
But you did it very well.
Well,
so,
thank
I mean,
you.
To do something that you hate well, it's pretty good credit to you.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, I'm never the top fundraiser in any quarter among my colleagues, because mm-hmm. I won't spend as much time doing it as other people do.
Yeah.
And I feel really strongly that I think it, particularly in a district like this, that good results and good work go a long way. Obviously, you still have to raise money, unfortunately, but
yeah.
but I do believe that it's not quite as important in this district.
I've been impressed with the success you've had at being independent, if you will. I don't mean independent versus Democrat versus Republican, but I mean independent of any catching. You know, you're independent in a place that disdains independence, right? There's a certain degree of expectation you're going to toe the line. How's that working for you? I mean, like, for example, you were late, I will use that phrase politely, in coming to the decision that you think you ought to take a look at the president from an impeachment perspective. I understand you're getting all kinds of nasty mail and comments about your coming out in favor of that. But the impeachment thing, I mean, there's no way we can have this show and not talk about impeachment. I hate it. But because, you know, people ought to be good at what they do. I mean, this guy has no loyalty to anyone or anything except his own self-promotion. And so every day it's like I look forward to watching the news just to see what crazy stuff this president has done. What do you want to say about impeachment? And then we'll move on.
Well, let me just say this. Your question started as, you know, my independent streak. One of the advantages of having been around for the block a few times in my life, and having had a 35-year career as a lawyer, is that I'm pretty well formed in terms of my moral compass. So I invariably, if I'm caught between two spots and I just can't figure out which way to go, I always try to retreat to that, you know, to thine own self be true, and I retreat to my own moral compass. And that seems to be working pretty well for me. You're right. On the impeachment issue, I was one of the later people to come out in favor of an inquiry. And On the Democratic side. And I only did so after the Ukraine phone call came to light. And I was getting a lot of pressure, not at that point from the right, but from the left, people who were really upset that I had not come out for impeachment based on the Mueller report and Russia and so forth. And what I always said to people, and I mean this, is that as a trial lawyer, I learned that you don't go to court until you had all your evidence lined up, your ducks in a row, whatever saying you want to use. And I didn't feel that we were there yet. The Ukraine phone call completely changed things for me. At that point, it became a matter of national security. It became a matter of foreign powers, that our elected president had leverage over, and in turn was providing them potentially with leverage over us. That to me warrants an inquiry. So I think it's just a matter of being very true to yourself. And when you're in a difficult decision-making process, deciding what can I live with, what will not prevent me from sleeping at night.
Yeah, so we've got a president who, nothing surprises me anymore. Some of this stuff is so wildly out of the realm of normal, politically even, that we're not even paying attention to some of the most basic aspects of the job of being president. For example, having appointed officials in place so they could do cabinet departments can do their job. And there are huge numbers of senior positions that haven't even been nominated, much less filled. So how is the government functioning in an environment where key decision makers aren't in place? I mean, the State Department has got to be a disaster, as probably most of the other departments. And we don't even talk about that.
Well, I think a lot of it's by design. It's not by negligence. It's by design.
Hate government, prove that it doesn't work by making sure it doesn't work.
I guess something like that.
And then be able to point to it and say, see?
And, I think it's also centralized all power in a very small group of people in the administration and, to our country's detriment, if you ask me. And we're starting to see the consequences of that.
You know, things like in the past, we would criticize a president because or a candidate because they didn't appear presidential. What happened to that standard? There's so many aspects of this.
It's interesting, Alan, because I hear from people all the time who voted for Trump and are grudgingly Trump supporters, and they always want to excuse themselves by saying, I don't like the way he behaves. I don't like what he says.
I don't like his policies.
They won't even go that far. It'll usually be, but, sometimes they like his policies. Sometimes it's a comment on, but the stock market is strong. The economy is strong, to which my response is, if you're in the stock market, you're doing well.
Right.
But a lot of, the average American isn't.
Right. Let's get into was there a point in your life that some change occurred? How did you get your mindset? Was there like a defining moment in your life that pushed you in a certain direction in terms of what you wanted to be when you grow up, kind of thing?
It sounds trite, but my mother was a huge force in my life. My father was also, but my mother in particular. I grew up in a household with a mother who was a professional. Her mother was a professional. So my grandmother, you'll love this, was one of the first female radio broadcasters in the United States.
No kidding. Wow.
She, for the one in Philadelphia. I can't think what it's called right now. Anyway, so I was always told that it wasn't suggested to me that I would have a career, that I needed a purpose in life outside of raising a family. That it was important to be independent and be able to be independent. So I took that very much to heart. I went to law school, and I didn't really know that I would end up as a litigator. But being a litigator really made me find my voice.
Yeah.
I look back at myself when I was 24, and I'm almost not the same person just because so I can't point to a single moment. I can just tell you that it's an accumulation of experiences over my professional career that really changed me.
Well, I am not a particularly good radio broadcast guy because I keep forgetting to self-identify. This is WDIY. It's listener-supported public radio, part of the NPR network. And I'm your host on a show called Lehigh Valley Discourse, which I haven't even mentioned until now. In fact, I hadn't even identified myself as the host until now. I'm Alan Jennings. Hopefully my voice is familiar to you. We're going to take a short break, and we have a fascinating guest this evening, Susan Wild, our congresswoman in the 7th Congressional District. Stick with us.
WDIY is gearing up for our 2019 fall membership drive, starting Friday, October 11th. Once again, we are giving you the opportunity to buy back an entire weekend from the drive. If we can raise $16,000 before this Friday, we'll have an entire uninterrupted weekend of the WDIY programs you love. Come together right now. And support Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Make your buyback gift today at WDIY.org.
All right, welcome back. I'll say it again. This is WDIY. Lehigh Valley Public Radio. This is actually the show is called Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host tonight. We have other hosts throughout the month. I have the good fortune of having my friend and our congresswoman, Susan Wild, in the studio here at WDIY. And very happy to have you here, Susan. Thanks for being here. 2018 was a banner year for women, at least in politics. Is there a sisterhood?
Sure, there is. Of course, there is the largest freshman class with the largest number of women ever elected to Congress. So, of course, there's a sisterhood. I have my own sisterhood right here in Pennsylvania. They're the only freshmen who came out of Pennsylvania in November last year. Were four women elected from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So, and the four of us are fast friends, and we always have each other's backs. But in addition to that, so there is a sisterhood, but there are a lot of really good men who are part of that sisterhood. Huh. And I say that not to be politically correct, but because I am fascinated by the number of men in Congress who are really boosting us up. And not, you know, I was practicing law for a long time, so I saw I'm not going to call it discrimination, but I saw the effects of people not really accepting that I was a trial lawyer, you know, being asked if I was the court reporter or somebody's paralegal and that kind of thing. Those are in the early days of my career. I don't sense any of that. There are a number of women who are chairs of committees, and it feels very egalitarian right now, at least on my side of the aisle.
Do you hang out with any of the sisterhood on the Senate side of the building?
I see them. We don't tend to have a whole lot of interaction just because of the nature of our jobs.
Huh. What caucuses are you in? Have you signed up for any caucuses?
So I'm in a number of caucuses. I'm in the Pro-Choice Caucus. I am in the New Dems Coalition, which is not a caucus, but it's 104 Democrats who tend to be from more moderate districts and are very focused on market-driven solutions to problems. I am a member of I really should be better prepared here for the caucus question.
Okay. I mean, there are plenty of them.
There are so many caucuses. I'm a member of the Secular Caucus. I just recently joined that because I have such a firm belief in the separation of church and state.
You have an interesting perspective. You were raised a Christian, but you got married and converted to Judaism, right?
Yeah, I was raised by a Quaker mother and a Methodist father, and later converted to Judaism.
Wow, that's a pretty good spread you got there.
I feel comfortable in any house of worship, let's say that.
Let's play either or. It's a segment I call that where I give you two opposing perspectives and you pick which side you're on.
Okay.
You'll get a chance to add color and detail, but try to be an anti-politician and try to give me a yay or nay kind of thing before you get into the nuance of the question. Either Trump or Pence.
Is Lincoln available?
I'm sorry. That one's not available.
It's the best I can do on that one.
Medicare for all or the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I'll be serious on this one. We have to work towards comprehensive universal health care coverage. We have to work towards single payer, yes. But I think the best way we do it right now is by building on the Affordable Care Act. But it's clear we can't stop there. We have to work towards achieving Medicare for all. I don't think we managed to do that this Congress. And that's why I have been working very hard on improving portions of the ACA. And absolutely protecting pre-existing conditions.
One of the most outspoken and strong supporters of Medicare for All is, in fact, one of your constituents, and that's Richard Master at MCS Industries.
I know Richard well.
I'm sure you do. And Richard's a terrific guy. But my perspective is the business community ought to be in favor of a single payer and universal health care system because the business community is bearing all the burden of the health care system. And in a single-payer system, they would get all that out from... I never understood why health insurance had anything to do with employment. I mean, you still need health care when you're unemployed. That doesn't make any sense to me.
We're the only fully developed country in the world that follows that model. And I agree with you. I don't understand why businesses don't get behind it more. Although I will tell you, I think small businesses in particular would very much like to see at least a public option within the Affordable Care Act. And I think that we absolutely have to move in that direction, not just for people who have no insurance, but for small businesses to thrive. I think to have a public option would make a huge difference.
I have a problem with the use of the term public option. To me, it sounds like government boondoggle. I mean, if Republicans had proposed the public option, and they did, because originally this stuff was Romney, Gingrich, and Nixon, right?
Yes.
And so they would call it Healthy America, or the Healthcare Opportunity Fund.
Well,
we call it public option.
I've long thought that the way we title things is a problem. I think the term Medicare for All is a problem. I really think we need to call it something else, like you just said, Healthy America.
Who's opposed to Healthy America?
Right, exactly. The problem, Medicare for All tends to be one of those phrases that just makes people a little crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, you've got people who are on Medicare. Well, or you have people who are on Medicare now who have spent their entire lives paying into it, and they're worried that their own benefits will be diminished if we make it for everybody. So our nomenclature is important.
Continuing on with either or, Harris or Biden?
Sorry, Alan, I'm not going there. And honest, let me just say.
So I won't ask Warren or Biden.
Well, let me just say this. I'm going to tell you what I really have not made my own mind up on this. I've been asked by a few of the presidential candidates to endorse them. My response to all of them is, if you don't come to the 7th District of Pennsylvania, you are missing the boat. This is the biggest swing district in the biggest swing state.
Yep.
Bernie Sanders came early on and did a town hall. Other than that, we have not seen a single presidential candidate here. So I have no interest in endorsing any candidate until they come and talk to the people of the 7th District.
Good for you. Tax increases or more budget cuts?
Alan, I feel strongly that the wealthy in America are not paying their fair share. So to that end, I think they should contribute more. But we certainly, we always have to be looking at waste. I don't think that Social Security and Medicare is waste. But think about things like this. We don't negotiate prescription drug prices as part of Medicare.
That
is one of the biggest travesties. So you want to cut the price of, you want to cut how much
compete.
Medicare costs? Well, let's start negotiating our drug prices with pharma.
It's amazing. It's truly amazing. The next one I can't even believe I can put in front of you, but Europe or North Korea? We have a president who has turned our relationships in Europe sour, who is praising that little goofball in North Korea who's dangerous.
So, Ellen, I just returned at the end of August from a trip to Germany. It was an official trip. I went with a group of Republicans and one other Democrat, and we were there really to focus on workforce development issues and how different countries approach the issue of workforce development, which is a big problem that we have here. I will tell you that our German counterparts are dismayed by the relationship between the EU and the U.S., and particularly I'm talking about the administration's approach to the EU. So I'm going to pretend that the question is, who should the American president trust and work with? And the answer to that clearly is our European allies.
Yeah. You know, when I go over, when I was over in Scandinavia this summer, and I found, you know, as I often do, I was apologizing for our president. And most of them were saying, they weren't all over me about Trump because they're all having the same kinds of challenges. You know, Austria, Poland, Norway, they all have these kind of populist right-wing extremists that are gaining ground. And, you know, for a person that believes in civilized society, that's scary.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Mortgage interest deduction for $600,000 homes plus beach houses, or more funding to help meet the housing needs of poor and working people. That's as loaded as it gets.
Well, that's an easy one for me, Alan. I'll always stand on the side of the poor and working class over the wealthy and the well-connected, plain and simple. I feel as though the wealthy and well-connected can take care of themselves.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. My guest is Susan Wild, new member of Congress. I guess you're still new, at least until your second term, maybe. And I'm Alan Jennings, your host. And in the studio with me is Elsie LeBoy, who once worked for us, and Susan stole her from us, and she got a good one there. I love Elsie. So, Elsie.
Yeah, Elsie is one of our housing specialists.
She knows what she's doing.
Because she gained her experience and knowledge from working with CACLV.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. We're honored to have her.
Yes. All right, so back to the sober stuff. Why is racism so alive in a nation that professes to be about liberty and justice for all? What is up with us?
I've given this a lot of thought, Alan. I wish I had a perfect answer. And the only answer I can come – the question you asked is why. I think it's based in fear. I think it is fear that peaceful and equitable coexistence will somehow threaten – one's own position in this world. So those of us who are, privileged enough to have white skin and a good income and the benefit of a good education, for whatever reason, feel that if other people who don't look like us or speak our language are given the same things, that our existence will somehow be diminished. That's the best answer I can come up with on the why question.
And, you know, people, I think a lot of people who are white, their attitude is, I don't own any slaves. Why are you blaming me? They don't understand how systemic racism is and how almost factory-like its efficiency is. And we've gotten so much better at racism, you know? I mean, they don't understand that minimum lot sizes in zoning land use is essentially an exclusionary action. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to have a half acre lot to live in this community. Well, guess who that's leaving out? Yeah. The way we fund public education, I would argue that, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, I don't think we've made any progress since 1954. So what is it that is going to get us to some parity in education? You're on Labor HHS.
I am on the Education and Labor Committee, as well as Foreign Affairs. I spend the bulk of my time in Education and Labor because I think it's so important to this district. I will tell you, at the federal level, so much of our focus is on higher education, and I'm not suggesting that we don't need focus there too. We do. We need to help people get out under this load of student loan debt that's going to stop them from buying houses and getting married and having their own children, which is what our economy depends on, let's face it. But in addition to that, I mean, we just aren't doing anything at the zero for the children who are 0 to 18.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people say, well, my family, I had to work for that. Or, the truth of the matter is
we can do better.
Not only that, we don't choose the families we're born into.
Right.
You know, I had the good fortune to be born to American parents and who were
in the 21st or 20th century, yeah, right?
Who were solidly middle class.
Who loved you.
Yes.
And cared for you. And yeah.
And we weren't rich, but they had enough money to provide, you know, for me. That's as much an accident of birth as anything else. I am a big believer that federal funding needs to be used to help our early childhood education programs. We have to more fully fund Head Start. It's criminal that such a small percentage of eligible families are able to put their children in Head Start.
You beat me to that subject. I was going to make the point that early childhood education has clearly been shown to be an outstanding return on investment. I think early childhood education ought to be an entitlement for every American child.
Well, I always try to stay away from the term entitlement because it's become such a dirty word. But I will tell you that I think not only should every child in this country receive early childhood education, quality, free or affordable childhood education, but I also think that our country depends on it. And that's the part that's getting lost. So if I'm talking to somebody,
our labor supply.
If I'm talking to somebody who has a real problem with it as an entitlement, as you put it, I could point out that if we don't educate our young and if they don't go on to prosper and have good jobs, those of us who want to retire later in life, we're not going to be able to because there's not going to be a body of productive human beings there to support the rest of us in our old age.
Yeah. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. My guest this evening is the one and only Susan Wild, the member of Congress representing the 7th Congressional District in Pennsylvania. You elected her, and she's going to be having to face you again. Susan, what would you say is your most noteworthy achievement? I mean, if you're going to run on an issue that you can brag about that you have something to do with, because I know it's tough to get anything done in your first term just because you're a junior member of Congress and everything. But what one thing would you really drive home to voters and people you hope to expand your support base?
My advocacy skills, which obviously were honed over many years of practicing law in the courtroom. It has been commented upon by more senior members of Congress that they value having me on a committee, that I'm able to discern very tough issues in a very quick amount of time, question witnesses artfully, and use my cross-examination skills. But the important thing about that is that it means that it puts me in a position to advocate for my constituents, number one, but it also enables me to advocate across the aisle. So you asked about a single accomplishment, and I always have to come back to when we were passing the Protecting People with Pre-Existing Conditions Act earlier this year. I had an amendment to that bill that provided that no executive action could be taken by the administration, this administration or any future administration, that would have the intended or unintended effect of raising premiums on people with pre-existing conditions. Mm. Okay, that's a lot of words. I lobbied for that across the aisle. I got 78 Republican votes on that amendment. It was the most number of votes.
Wow. I didn't know they did anything.
How about that, right? So when I was watching the screen that we have in our on the floor where you can see how many Democrats have voted, how many Republicans have voted, and how they voted, it was very exciting to see that I got 78 Republican votes.
And you were the prime sponsor?
I was the prime sponsor.
Oh, way to go.
I
didn't know that one.
Yes.
Let's talk about another really hot and difficult subject, and that's reproductive rights, which is a euphemism for abortion in most cases. I was on the board of Planned Parenthood all through my 20s, not just at the local level, but at the state and national level. So I consider myself to be solidly pro-choice. The progress of medical science raises questions about the viability of the trimester rationale in Roe versus Wade. How does that change? I mean, a viable fetus that's 5 months old, is a medical miracle. Does that change the debate in any way, one way or the other?
Well, the debate over Roe versus Wade should not change based on medical science, because the fundamental issue, in my view, is a woman's right to control what's happening with her own body. So I don't think the medical science issue is what should control. Now, having said that, you know, obviously Roe versus Wade was determined based on viability and so forth. There are viability issues that come into question and that have to be discussed. But I am a firm believer in that the government has no place in a doctor's office with a woman and her healthcare provider. We don't ask in fact, most people who were opposed to pro-choice positions don't want the government interfering with much of anything, and yet they're willing to have the government interfere with a woman's right to choose. And I think that's unacceptable.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings, and having a ton of fun interviewing Susan Wild, the new member of Congress representing this new congressional district, the 7th District in Pennsylvania. Stay with us. We'll be back after a very quick break.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
Okay, welcome back. I told you it was a short break. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, listener-supported Lehigh Valley Public Radio. My guest this evening is Susan Wild, member of Congress. Let's talk about what I consider to be the most threatening issue on the planet right now, and apparently for some time, and that is climate change. This issue scares the hell out of me. I mean, I believe that the species is literally at risk, and yet we are basically whistling past the graveyard, at least with the, I mean, Donald Trump is taking us back, and you know, further every day. And, you know, people all around the world, especially kids, are saying, wait a minute, I want a planet that I can live on. And I think, you know, I mean, it's almost like a form of child abuse that we are not dealing with this issue. We know it's a problem. It's showing itself every day. The people that don't believe in science are the people who, you know, think that Adam and Eve went to church on a dinosaur. You know, I mean, and yet the issue doesn't penetrate the top 10 issues on people's minds.
It does for young people, let me tell you.
It does for young people, right. So what do you think is doable these days? Let me just add one more thing to this. I have a good friend who's a retired engineer, smart guy, air products retiree, who said to me that he understands that the science is real. He understands that it's our fault as humans. But he says he doesn't think we should do any damage to the economy addressing the issue. So that's almost, I mean, to some that might sound like a moderated position. To me, that sounds almost worse, that you're willing to say, yes, the species is threatened, but nah, I got to make enough money. Where do you come down on this stuff? I mean, the Green New Deal is a pretty cool proposal. I don't think it's extremist. Some, obviously, plenty do. Where do you come down on all this?
So let me just start, Alan, by saying I've got two kids in their mid-20s, so they're part of that generation of people who are really worried about climate change. As their mother, I am very worried about climate change. I hope someday to have grandchildren. I want the world to be here for them.
Yeah.
I want the planet to be a good place to live and breathe and grow up. I did not sign on to the Green New Deal, but although I give it props for the fact that it has forced all of us to have these conversations, but more than the conversations, because frankly, we've been having the conversations too long. It's time to start doing something about it. And so what I have really focused on is how do we find the solutions? I mean, let's stop talking about it. Let's start finding solutions.
Research.
I mentioned before that I'm part of the New Dems Coalition. The New Dems Coalition is very focused on market-driven solutions. I think I mentioned that before. And I'm the co-chair of the New Dems Climate Change Task Force.
Oh, cool.
One of my co-chairs, by the way, is a climate scientist and is now in Congress. So, you know, it's not we've got some really sterling ideas. My problem with the Green New Deal was that is I think it's a wonderful statement of aspiration, and I think it's where we need to get to. But it doesn't have any actual legislation attached to it. And we haven't seen any legislation since it was
initially. So it's just a manifesto at this point.
And it's great as a manifesto. But what I have done is I've signed on to a bill that was introduced by Ted Deutsch from Florida. Ted, by the way, grew up in this area. His sister is one of my constituents. And,
no kidding.
Yeah, has roots right here in the Lehigh Valley. His bill is to create a carbon dividend trust fund that encourages market-driven innovation of clean energy technologies. And along those lines,
that's
let me
cool.
say this. I really do believe that industries are good at solving problems, but they often have to be pushed to do so. So that's the government's role. That's public opinion's role. But I am so encouraged when I talk to manufacturers here in this district, which I do every single time I'm home. I'm at one manufacturing facility or another. They're already ahead of where the government is in terms of their solutions, in terms of their problem solving. And so do we need regulation? Absolutely, because I think they need that kick in the rear to get to do it. But I think we also need to give them incentives to create solutions for their whatever their industry might be. So I've met with the cement. You asked me what caucuses I'm in. I'm actually in the cement caucus.
Cement caucus. That's,
yeah, because I bet you didn't know, or
you
maybe you did know that the Lehigh Valley is, you know, one of the biggest producers of cement in the world.
But by German companies.
Not entirely, but I actually visited them in Germany also. But cement is also one of the largest emitters of carbon. Well, so in Germany, one of the places I visited was Heidelberg Cement, which has a branch here, and they have a very forward-thinking program for carbon capture and innovation, and the things that they're doing are they know how to do it better than we do. But as I said, you've got to provide the regulatory push, you've got to have public opinion behind it and demanding it. So, that I think is the direction we have to go in. I also am a big believer, and we've also already voted on this, the all climate solutions start with the Paris Agreement resolution to send a simple but strong message that Congress is committed to the Paris Agreement. I'm encouraged by the fact that most companies, corporations around the country and municipalities have continued to abide by the terms of the Paris Climate Agreement, even though the administration stated its intention to withdraw. I think that, you know, the truth of the matter is the people at the top of industries, they have kids too. They have grandchildren.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not suggesting that they don't put profits before climate change. Sometimes they do, but I also think they recognize it as an essential component of how they're going to continue to do business.
You know, I've spent almost 40 years trying to solve community problems, and I've taken on issue after issue after issue. One of the things that's most exciting to me is the progressive leadership at the top of a lot of American companies these days.
Yes.
You know, in the last several years, just in the last few years, I should say, there seems to have been a tectonic shift in the approach that top corporate CEOs are taking these days. We've got a race initiative coming around that we'll talk about off the show, because I don't want to preempt our own announcement. We've got a race initiative that we're working on. PPL is way at the top in being progressive about issues involving diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have business leadership leading the way, you know, basically is saying to people, it's okay to be a conservative and care about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when you think about it, Democrats really have always been the ones that have advanced the progressive agenda. But to hear Republican business leaders stand up and say, this is what's good for this country, and whether we can make money or not, we got to do the right thing, is something that is very, very encouraging.
And a lot of it, I think, is actually employee-driven and shareholder-driven. When you have employees and shareholders who are demanding action, it goes a long way towards bringing about change. I have been, yesterday I was at an insurance company's offices. They recently moved into a new building. It's LEED Gold certified, so it meets all kinds of environmental standards. They have a lot of outdoor space for their employees. They have natural light throughout the building. Huh. You know, the way things are being designed is really important, not only for employee satisfaction and that kind of thing, but also towards solving some of these issues. I'm also a believer, and I talk about this sometimes, probably not enough, that we need to spend part of our defense budget on solving the climate change problem. The military is very good at accomplishing tasks, better than probably any other segment of our society.
Well, that's because they got rank. You got to do what the boss
exactly
says.
But they set a goal and they accomplish it because, you know, that, as you said, because they have bosses who dictate right. that. And I think we need to start spending part of our defense budget, because climate change is a defense, is a national security issue. We need to start spending more of our defense budget on climate change issues.
State Department. Let's go back to that. You're a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee,
right?
What would you say is the status of our relationships abroad? I mean, we talked about Europe. I don't think we realize how bad it is that we have a bad relationship with the other most civilized part of the free world. What are you alarmed by, or what's the main agenda for you? And why, for that matter, are you on the Foreign Affairs Committee? Because that's usually something that you hear is in the Senate's domain. You know what
right.
I mean?
So I was asked to be on the Foreign Affairs Committee by Ted Deutch and Elliot Engel. I considered it an honor. It's not generally something one gets on as a freshman.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have requested it, but once I was asked to be on it, I thought that it was important. I have a deep interest in foreign affairs. And I balanced it by making sure that education and labor is my first focus. But foreign affairs affects all of us. You know, one of the things we deal with often is talking about trade issues in Africa. I'm the vice chair of the Africa subcommittee. Well, the Chinese are way ahead of us in terms of development in Africa. Mm. And these are all things that are going to benefit, you know, companies, eventually industries, and our economy. So foreign affairs isn't just about going to war and making sure that we have allies in the event of a threat. It's also about trade, and trade has become part of my new passion. What I hear consistently, I heard it a lot in Germany, and I hear it from witnesses who testify in front of foreign affairs, is that our relationships with our European allies are dwindling. Most of the European countries tend to consider it to be strictly a matter of the administration and its approach. I don't think all Americans are being labeled as, you know, not trustworthy.
I sensed no hostility when I was in Scandinavia.
Yeah, I don't think there is. I think when a bunch of us went to Germany, they were very happy to see us sort of as ambassadors for our country,
yeah,
as people that they could talk to. And as I said, the trip was a preponderance of Republicans on the trip, and we all got along very well. But we all had the same concerns and issues in terms of our relationship with other countries.
I don't need to ask the question. It's really a Trump thing. But diplomacy seems to have been lost as an agenda item for us as a country.
Well, that's a shame. I think that diplomacy is a wonderful way of accomplishing.
Save a lot of money. You don't
you know,
have to go to war when you're diplomatic.
Put in a really simple way, diplomacy is about having friends. It's very hard for a friend to say no to you.
Yeah.
This is putting it at the most basic level. If you ask a friend for a favor, it's very hard for them to say no. When you take it to a national level or an international level, and you have these friendships, which is otherwise known as diplomacy, it's much easier to get what you need, what you want from your friends.
Yeah, nobody wants to help a bully.
Well, you said it best.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest this evening is Susan Wild, the congresswoman from the 7th Congressional District, my congresswoman, most likely your congresswoman. Let's talk about another really easy topic, guns.
Okay.
I don't get guns. I don't understand it. why is it okay for someone to own an automatic weapon or a semi-automatic weapon? Why are we as a country willing to accept regular people who could go off at any minute picking up an automatic weapon and mowing down a crowd of people for no reason except that he's a hateful jerk? Why is that? Why? I mean, how can the NRA have that much of a grip on us as a nation that we could think it's okay for people to own automatic weapons? If you need an automatic weapon to shoot a deer, you shouldn't be hunting.
Well, let me start by saying that takes us back to H.R. 1 and getting dark money out of politics, getting big money out of politics. You mentioned the NRA. Pharma's in the same boat, you know, in terms of having an awful lot of influence in Washington. It's why I don't take corporate PAC money. Not that the NRA is beating my door down, but I don't want pharma money either because I want to be able to make these decisions free of any kind of influence from corporations. Having said that, in answer to your question about guns, you know, the kind of weapons that you just mentioned are weapons of war. And recently I reached out to a number of people in the community who I know who happen to own AR-15s. Okay.
Hanging around with the wrong people.
Listen, I've gotten to know an awful lot of people in the 2 years I was campaigning for this office. And my question to them was, you know, we're considering introducing an assault weapon ban, and I'd like to hear your reaction to it. You know, and I mean, this is what I do. I reach out to people and get their take on things. And what I was told uniformly by the people I reached out to is, you know, I said, why do you own one? And the answer was, because they're fun to shoot. And then I said, well, where do you shoot them? Would you use it for self-defense? And one guy said to me, and this just really struck me, he said, I couldn't use it to shoot an intruder. I'd end up shooting my next-door neighbor. That's how powerful it is.
Wow.
I said, do you use it to hunt? And he said, there would be nothing left of the animal if I hunted with it. So where do you use it? Well, I use it at a target range. And it's
okay,
fun
so
to
leave
shoot.
Them there.
Right. So,
lock them
so,
up in the locker.
But almost to a person, they said, you know, if I had to give up my AR-15, I would. You know, I would understand that there's the greater good involved. Now, I don't tell anybody they should give up their handgun or their weapons of self-defense that they might feel that they need to have in their home under lock and key. I'm not going there, and I don't believe that. But I don't see why we need to have weapons of war. I just want to say one more thing, if I have time here, Alan, on the issue of gun violence. What we hear about on cable news, of course, are the mass shootings. We hear about school shootings and that kind of thing. The reality is that is a small fraction of the violence that is inflicted by guns in this country, because the violence that we really should be talking about is the violence that happens within families, suicides by guns, domestic violence abusers who use guns to shoot and kill. And that is something that really could be helped by passing the background check, which we've passed in the House, but of course is sitting on Mitch's desk.
There's plenty more to talk about. We didn't get into behavioral health, which I hope to do, and I apologize for that. You've been great on that issue, and it's not terribly unfortunate circumstances. We've run out of time. I've had a lot of fun interviewing Susan Wild. I'm Alan Jennings. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Susan, thanks so much for being a part of this.
Thanks, Alan. This was enjoyable.